All right, welcome to Making the Argument. Before we get started, I have a very important announcement. We have a brand new deal with GoodRanchers.com. That's right. If you go into Good Ranchers and you use promo code Nick and you sign up for one of their subscriptions, you're not only going to get $15 off, but do you remember the old deal where you got 2 pounds of ground beef with each order? Well, we just upped the game. That's right. You can choose top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, or bacon now. Every single order you get on that subscription is going to come with free top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, or bacon. You get to choose which one if you use promo code Nick. And again, $15 off on top of that. That's a savings of $480 in meat by signing up for one of those subscriptions. Not to mention the fact that if you are looking for a gift for someone that is impossible to shop for, you can go on to goodranchers.com and get one of their brand new gift boxes. Now, this is a limited time only offer. It's part of their overall Black Friday special. So go on to goodranchers.com to get more details. Sign up for promo code Nick in order to get that deal, and let's get on with the show.
Because one thing I've learned is this, in politics and in combat, cowardice is contagious, but so is courage. And if you're willing to be the first person over those ramparts, you will be shocked at how many people will come with you. I'm asking you to come with me. I'm asking you to be a part of the generation that will restore the promise of this country and breathe new life into it.
Hi, this is Nick Freitas, and today on Making the Argument, we're going to dedicate this podcast episode to answering questions that our viewers have sent in and our listeners have sent in for our podcast, as well as some other events that we've done through Facebook Live town halls and things of that nature. So over the last 15 episodes, we've gotten a lot of great questions from our viewers, and we just want to dedicate the time to answering those questions because we know, you can't possibly answer everything in 1 to 2 minute responses or in even a 20-minute podcast, especially when we're addressing some of these difficult, complex issues. So that's what we're going to do today. We're going to dedicate ourselves to that. The other thing that we want you all to understand is we do read your questions. We do read your comments. We try to make sure that whatever content we're providing on the podcast is actually fueled by the feedback that you're giving us and the arguments that you would like to learn how to make or the issues that you want more information on so that when you're engaging in those conversations with friends, family, and coworkers, you feel confident on presenting the arguments for conservative values and principles in a way that is successful. So without any further ado, let's go ahead and get to your questions. So the first one I want to get to here is from Janice, and it was from our cronyism and capitalism episode. If you remember, one of the things we talked about there as well was the role of lobbyists within a government. How do lobbyists interact with politicians? Is lobbying a good thing? Is it a bad thing? And Janice said, these podcasts cost money, as do travel and other campaigning. Where is your financing coming from? You can say you will not deal with lobbyists that try to buy you. So tell us about your financing. Great question. So we get financing from donors. So again, this podcast is being run through our campaign, our nick4va.com. This is our congressional race here in the Virginia 7th District. And we get donations from all over the 7th Congressional District in Virginia, all over Virginia, and really all over the country. And the way that I explain how we go about fundraising is I try to make sure that you guys understand that whenever somebody is investing in a campaign, I look at, that's what you're doing. You're investing. You're saying that this is someone that I want to see in the legislature, in the executive branch, whatever it is. And there's certain results that you would like to see based off of that. Now, you're not paying for those results. What you're doing is you're saying that this representative or this person believes the same things I believe, are going to fight for the things that I would like to see happen for this country. And so therefore, I want to help them be able to be successful with respect to their campaign, et cetera. And that's how we do it. So I have to spend a lot of time on the phone calling donors, convincing them that this is a good campaign to invest in. One of the things that we do is we highlight the podcast. We highlight our Facebook Live town halls we do. We highlight all those different ways that we're getting out and connecting with not just our voters, but really voters all over the country. Because one of the things I've really tried to emphasize is that whenever you're looking at politics, that's just one front in a much larger cultural battle. And I think, we've had a lot of success with our fundraising capabilities by, again, just making the simple arguments for conservative values in a way that is relevant to a diverse audience. And so that's how we get our financing. Another question was, is where do you stand on the actions of Rand Paul? Again, this was with respect to the cronyism and capitalism episode. I think if you look at a lot of the things that Rand Paul has done in the Senate, he has been someone to watch because he's very, very principled. And this is one of the things that I also try to stress to people. A lot of times people say, well, if you're so conservative, how do you work with people on the other side of the aisle? And I would say that the most important aspect to working with other people is not compromising your principles. Right, that's a false dilemma. If you're constantly trying to compromise on your principles in order to work with people across the aisle, you're not really working with them, you're being co-opted. All right, genuine compromise or genuine teamwork doesn't involve either side having to surrender on their core principles or their core values. So here's a good way I put it. In the General Assembly within Virginia, I am arguably the most conservative member of the General Assembly, like tied with probably a few other people who also have very, very conservative voting records. Yet I work with Democrats on various bills, and one example would be civil asset forfeiture reform. So I don't think it's appropriate for the government to confiscate and sell your property without convicting you of a crime or without, you know, giving you a plea bargain or whatever it is. So I carried legislation for a few years trying to move it from civil asset forfeiture to criminal asset forfeiture. Well, last year, Delegate Marcus Simon, who's probably one of the more liberal delegates, came up and asked if he could co-patron that bill. I said, yeah, no problem. So in that particular issue, civil asset forfeiture reform, I looked at it as a conservative issue. Maybe he looked at it as a liberal issue. But the bottom line is we had a common objective there. And that is when you actually see good bipartisan work on something. It's not when either side is forced to surrender values. I probably disagree with Marcus Simon on 98% of the issues. All right, now, and on those 98% of the issues, we're going to go back and forth. We're going to battle on those issues. But on the 2% where we agree on something like civil asset forfeiture reform, I know that he will, if he gives me his word that he's going to support something, he'll do it. And he knows that if I give him my word I'm going to support something, he knows I'll do it. Why? Because 98% of the time when we disagree, there's no confusion, right? Neither one of us surprise our constituents with respect to how we vote or the things that we believe in because we've both been honest with our constituents and we've let the chips fall where they may when it comes to election cycles, right? If I'm not going to change who I am, if my constituents later decide that I don't effectively represent them, they can choose somebody else. But it's not worth losing your integrity in this business. And so I think working with people, it is, again, standing by your word and being faithful to it is actually one of the most important components to working effectively with other people, even people that you usually disagree with. Because if I can trust that when you give me your word, you're going to keep it, I can work with you. Maybe it's only 2% of the time, but we'll make that 2% count. Rand Paul has just done an excellent job on a variety of topics. When it comes to cronyism and capitalism, he's one of the people that's truly understood that there is a difference between the two. Cronyism is not capitalism. Capitalism requires the free, voluntary exchange between people. Cronyism is using the government to give yourself an advantage over your competition. And unfortunately, a lot of Republicans, I think, confuse the two, but Rand Paul is not one of them, and I think he's done an excellent job. And then the third part of that question was, what person or persons in Congress do you admire and would stand with? I think, Senator Rand Paul, Senator Mike Lee, Ted Cruz, Congressman Ben Klein, Congressman Jim Jordan, and there's several others that I would admire, be happy to stand with. The thing that I always tell people, though, is there can be people that you admire in politics. There can be people that you think you're going to work with a great deal of the time. But by the same token, my vote is my own, and I have a responsibility to do what I told my constituents I do and to stand up for those beliefs. And so if for some reason there's one time where I can't work with someone or I can't agree with somebody on something, that doesn't mean a friendship is lost. It doesn't mean that I don't overall support that person. It just means that I have to stay true to the values that I told my constituents I would effectively defend. So Janice, I hope that answers your question, and thank you very much for sending it in. All right, we got another one here, and this one was on the Scott Jenkins episode. So Sheriff Scott Jenkins, he's my local sheriff in Culpeper. He's gotten a lot of national attention. He was one of the first sheriffs, I think he might have been the first sheriff, to talk about deputizing citizens should the government come in and try to confiscate their firearms, because obviously if you're a sheriff's deputy, you have authorization to carry some of these things as a member of law enforcement. And Scott was one of the people that talked about the fact that he doesn't have limitations on who he can deputize and who he can deputize market ties is not limited to within the county that he represents. And so we had a great episode with Scott Jenkins talking not only about that, but really talking about the role of the sheriff in protecting our constitutional rights. And I can't recommend that episode enough. I think it provides a unique perspective on the role of different types of law enforcement within the country, the history of it, and what they're there to actually do. But Joe Milosevic had a question where he said, with the pandemic causing staffing issues, it does make one wonder what capabilities that the sheriffs have to emergency deputize individuals to fill gaps in the force. Would the state have to provide the emergency funding for the staffing issue? So here's what you need to understand about that. You can be deputized as a reserve officer. You can be deputized as someone that is only going to serve a minimal amount of time or a minimum amount of commitment during the week to the sheriff's office. So it's not as if you're having to staff a bunch of full-time positions. So there's different authorities for the sheriffs to be able to deputize people where they're not collecting, you know, the same pay as a full-time officer. And that's how I think you would run into a situation where you can still deputize and it doesn't completely break the budget of the sheriff's office. And I think that's one of the things that Sheriff Jenkins is talking about, is moving into a role where you have auxiliary people that can be called up when they're needed, but they're not paid just because they've been deputized. And so that would create a situation where you're no longer dependent upon a governor like we have in Virginia, Ralph Northam, who would clearly not support what Sheriff Jenkins is trying to do to protect our constitutional rights. Sheriff Jenkins can still exercise his authority without creating a huge budget issue. So I Joe, great question. I hope that answers it for you. Had another one here on our episode with Devin Nunes. So for those of you who don't know, and I'm sure most of you do, Congressman Devin Nunes, great guy. He was the former chair of the House Intelligence Committee, and now he's the ranking Republican member on House Intelligence. House Intelligence Committee was the one that really reviewed all the different information when they were considering the impeachment for President Trump. And I mean, we all saw how it just went into a complete show trial as soon as the Democrats and Adam Schiff took over that committee. Devin Nunes was able to come on and actually really give us some insight and perspective on what was going on behind the scenes, what the Intelligence Committee is supposed to do, what it's currently doing under the Democrats, how the media has responded to it. Again, it was a very informative episode if you kind of wanted to get an idea of the mindset and what was going on behind the scenes with respect to the whole impeachment. I call it a show trial because that's what I think it was. But he also talked a little bit about our intelligence community and what the intelligence committee oversees. And Chip Isabel had a great question, said, why do we need 17 agencies? Why not have one agency with 17 divisions that report up to one executive committee? We might have half a chance of someone knowing what everyone is doing. Seems like a lot of waste and very inefficient. So Chip, a good point. Here's a couple of I'm going to try to be fair to both sides of this. I do think that some consolidation would actually be appropriate. One of the reasons why we have a director of national intelligence was that they were supposed to actually kind of fulfill that role of allowing each agency to specialize in what they do, but then having a central point where we could affect better communication. Now, when we talk about the 17 agencies, it's important to understand that some agencies that we have that fulfill, you know, something maybe of an intelligence role, most of it's international. We're talking about the NSA, the CIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, which falls under DOD, but still provides intelligence services, the National Ground Intelligence Center, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And then we have various task force databases, things like that. Some intelligence gathering has more of a domestic role, in which case it's supposed to follow constitutional limitations on how it actually gathers and processes information and turns it into intelligence. And then on the international agencies, obviously there's a little bit different rules on the way that operates. The reason why you need different agencies sometimes is for two reasons. If you put everything under one person's command, you can have a particular command culture that, you know, if they have a background in human intelligence, but they don't know anything in signals intelligence or open source intelligence or, you know, MAZIN or measures and signals intelligence. So there's different disciplines, and there is actually some good reasons on why certain agencies have different responsibilities. The downside is the effective communication between different agencies. And some of that is just bureaucracy and unhealthy competition. But some of it also has to do with the fact that when you're looking at sharing information, if you look at security clearances, you have secret, you have top secret, you have secured compartmentalized information. So some of the different agencies use different tool sets and have access to different technology, different authorities that other agencies don't have. And there is some degree of autonomy that can be useful in having these various agencies focus on their particular skill set or the technology they use or the practices they use without having one central director that is, you know, maybe more favorable to a particular agency as opposed to a different one or a particular division as opposed to a different one. So I will say that while I do think some consolidation would certainly be appropriate within our intelligence communities, I don't want to give people the impression that it makes absolutely no sense to have the various agencies doing different jobs. One of the biggest things that we have to be concerned about at this point, I would say, is not necessarily how many agencies are, although that is a valid issue, but making sure that our intelligence agencies are not engaging in domestic spying or not engaging in things like just reading the metadata from all your emails or keeping information on U.S. citizens that is just not appropriate or they don't have the appropriate warrants. I think we need to do a lot of reform within FISA. Our FISA courts is the Foreign Intelligence Services. It's basically where they go to get, you know, the ability to do wiretaps and listen in and gather other information. You know, we need to be careful that FISA is not being used to, you know, spy on U.S. citizens. So to your overall point, 17 agencies, yes, we could probably consolidate some of those. Yes, we need to come up with more effective mechanisms in order to share information when appropriate. And the Director of National Intelligence is supposed to be able to provide that continuity among the agencies. But I when you look at his overall authority or her overall authority, I don't think it's there to actually affect the sort of stovepiping that we wanted to prevent in the future. But by the same token, we do have to recognize that different agencies have different roles, have different skill sets, different technologies, and sometimes that information, it's not that it's not being shared just because, again, of bureaucratic webs. Sometimes it's not being shared because there can be problems. The more people that have access to information, the more probability you have for leaks and everything else. And so that's why you do see, there's ineffective stovepiping, and then there is some stuff that is put in for security reasons. So I know that's kind of a convoluted answer. I'm sorry I can't give you a better one. But I worked somewhat in intel. My last job in Special Forces was as an 18 Fox, which is a Special Forces Intelligence Sergeant. I think it was the greatest job in the military because not only did I have the responsibility of going through and doing analysis and breaking out all of these different terrorist networks and getting reports from different agencies, from different sources. You know, sometimes we're throwing up unmanned aerial vehicles in order to get, imagery analysis. Then we're doing, geospatial analysis, signals intelligence, human intelligence, open source, and then bringing it all together in order to create a complete picture. And then as an 18 Fox, I didn't just hand that off to someone else. As an 18 Fox, I got to go execute that target. So our team, usually with our Iraqi scout platoon and whatnot, we would go hit the target that I got to develop the intel on, and so it was a great job. And so that's the perspective I'm coming from. Again, Chip, hope that answers your question. Probably not as satisfying as either of us would like, but again, some of these are fairly complex. So we got another question here from Joe on criminal. We did an episode on the conservative approach to criminal justice reform. So again, I think there's this idea, and I think it's somewhat fostered by popular culture, but also fostered by some of the advocates for criminal justice reform, as if it's automatically anti-law enforcement. And in our episode, A Conservative Approach to Criminal Justice Reform, I was laying out the case for the fact that, no, conservatives want law enforcement reform and criminal justice reform as well. We're very, very big on protecting civil liberties and constitutional rights. Our approach to it is very different. We don't see the police as the enemy. We see the police as performing a necessary function, and we're very appreciative of the fact that we have men and women in blue that are willing to go out there, put themselves in dangerous situations in order to protect people. Our question is how do we best equip them to do it as effectively as possible while maintaining a healthy respect for the Constitution, for civil liberties? And again, a lot of our solution to that has to do with the decentralization. Stop trying to run every law enforcement agency from Washington, D.C. or from state capitals. Community policing, time and time again, has demonstrated to be one of the most effective ways to really prioritize what the community wants their law enforcement to focus on, as opposed to what politicians and distant capitals want them to focus on. And so that's a huge part of our criminal justice reform package. Another part is actually asking legislators to be a little bit more humble about what they do. You know, the way I usually put it is men and women in police force live at the business end of every stupid idea politicians turn into law. And those same politicians that write these laws that lead to altercations with the public never want to take personal responsibility for the fact that they've overly criminalized society, or they've created a lot of opportunities for there to be altercations with police and citizens in a lot of cases where there probably shouldn't be. And so, again, our approach, we have something of it's a pro-citizen, pro-liberty, pro-law enforcement, and pro-rehabilitation. Conservatives don't want people locked up forever. We want people to be safe. And if someone's run afoul of the law and they need to be locked up, look, if they've hurt another human being, our approach is their first priority is restitution to the victim. You know, a lot of the problems that I have with some of my Democrat colleagues is when they talk about criminal justice reform, they always talk about from the perspective of, well, we need to release people. Like, well, wait a second. If somebody is in jail or incarcerated because they hurt another human being, whether they stole from them or physically abused them or whatever it is, no, incarceration might be the appropriate response, because my first sympathy is going to go toward the victim. Right. But when someone has demonstrated that maybe they were younger and they made a really bad mistake and they have rehabilitated, great. We want to afford them an opportunity to be able to go back into society and be successful. But they need to pay restitution to their victims. They need to pay for the crime that they did because they hurt another person. So that's our approach. But one of the questions I got in there had to do with early in the video, you spoke about the need to extend grace to law enforcement because they are human and make mistakes. To what extent does the need to extend grace go? Is there a bright red line that the mistakes of law enforcement should not cross and be expected to have grace extended to them? Absolutely. So when I was talking about grace being extended to law enforcement, what I was saying was more of, a lot of times the press will put out, you know, 30 seconds of a 2-minute video, and everybody is making decisions about what that officer did or what that officer didn't do based off of what they saw with incomplete information. And so I'm not talking about extending grace to an officer that's corrupt. I'm not talking about extending grace to an officer that's abusive, right? That is a betrayal. Any officer that uses their power and authority and to deliberately infringe or hurt another person or enrich themselves through corrupt means, I don't want any grace for them. I mean, on a biblical level, yes, I want grace. But from the law, no. That's someone that has not only committed a crime, but they have betrayed the trust of the people they're supposed to serve by committing that crime under the color of authority. So no, when you've got a corrupt officer or when you've got an abusive officer, I think that not only should they be removed from being an officer, but there needs to be criminal consequences to those actions when they violate the law. I'm talking about more of, you see these commentators come on and say, oh, there was a shootout between the police and a burglar or a, you know, whoever it is, and they shot the burglar 4 times. You know, that's excessive. Well, you know, okay, but I don't know the situation. You know, if the bottom line is I've been in combat, and I know I have a lot of friends that have been in combat, and there are situations where somebody gets hit once and they don't go down because the adrenaline's running, or somebody, a criminal might be up on methamphetamines or angel dust or whatever else it might be, to where they're not feeling pain the same way that somebody else would. And so unfortunately, we've got a lot of armchair quarterbacks within the media, a lot of armchair quarterbacks within the political environment that have no real concept of what it's like to have to return fire in a situation where you're scared not only for yourself, you're scared for your partner, you're scared for other innocent civilians, and you're trying to defuse a situation or neutralize a situation as quickly and effectively as possible. So it's not the movies, all right? This whole idea of running gun battles where someone takes a shot at 100 yards away with the pistol and hits them right in the gun of the enemy. And that's Hollywood. That crap isn't real life. And so I was just saying, let's extend some grace to law enforcement with the understanding that when you are operating, when you're making split-second decisions in a violent situation, you know, it is important to look back at that and look at it in the proper context and not just assume that we know what should have gone down in that particular situation. You know, the officer also deserves to tell their story. But again, when it comes to corruption, when it comes to deliberately breaking the law, when it comes to negligence, no, I'm not saying that the police get a pass on that. And you know what? I know a lot of police officers, they don't think they should get a pass on that. And they don't want officers that break the law while wearing the uniform to get a pass because they know it reflects poorly on them. It makes them harder to do their job within the community if you've got a corrupt officer that is completely spoiling the relationship with the people that you need information from, the people that you need to be able to cooperate with in order to effectively provide security for that community. So yeah, I think the bright red line comes down to when you have clearly violated the law, when it's been demonstrated that you had criminal intent or conspiratorial intent, you know, all of those things. Again, law enforcement is not above the law. Right? Just because you wear a uniform, whether it's military wearing law enforcement, doesn't mean you can violate the law. And so that the standard for citizens needs to apply. The standard for citizens is the same standard for law enforcement, in my opinion on that. But let's demonstrate a little bit of reasonableness and grace when it comes to analyzing a situation where an officer had to make a split-second decision in a violent and a potentially deadly situation. So I hope that clears up kind of what my intent was on that, Joe. And I really appreciate the question because, you know, one of the things I never like to be misunderstood. I try to do a good job explaining where I'm coming from, what my perspective is. I try to be very reasonable in my approach. But every once in a while, someone will hear something or someone will have a question on something I said. And a lot of times, I see this with the press all the time, they'll just go out and say, you know, Nick Freitas implied this. Well, no, I didn't imply that. I said this, and this is what I meant. So whenever you provide me a question like this, it gives me a chance to clarify, and I really appreciate it. Okay, another one from Michael Weiss. This is also on a conservative approach to criminal justice reform. And okay, so this is, I appreciate it. He goes, why is it so complicated for other politicians to understand things like this? You know, why can't they just use common sense and logic? Why is this such a foreign concept in politics? All right, so it's a good question. And a couple of things I want to break down here. You know, I can't remember who it was, but they were basically making the argument that ultimately all decisions are rational. That doesn't mean that every decision is good. It doesn't mean that every decision follows out to a very strong logical conclusion. It doesn't mean that every decision follows the data in a comprehensive way in order to come to arrive at truth. But every decision is rational, which means you have to look at the motivation for why a politician is doing something. There's this theory that when politicians make a decision, it's just they only have the best interest of their constituents in mind. Well, I think a lot of them do. I think a lot of them think they do, and I think a lot of them convince themselves that they do. But ultimately, politicians respond to incentives just like everyone else in society. And those incentives are kind of determined based off of a couple of things. It's determined based off of your worldview, right? Which your worldview is a number of things. It could be your political philosophy, your religious philosophy, your economic philosophy. But one of the easiest things to identify among politicians is they typically want to get reelected. And so when they're making decisions, they're oftentimes making decisions based off of what they think will help them get reelected. And if they think that their citizens or their constituents are just furious about something, well, they have a choice. They can go to those constituents and say, hey, I think you're right here, but I think you're wrong here, and I think this is what we need to do going forward. There's a lot of danger associated with that, making that argument. Now, is that the responsible thing to do if that's what the elected official believes? Absolutely. Believe me, I have gotten in trouble when my constituents were very mad about a particular issue and I said, okay, I understand why you're mad, but I don't think the solution you're offering is the correct one. Can I offer a different one? And let me explain why I think the solution you're offering could be detrimental to what you want to achieve. And I've had constituents sit down and talk with me and say, you know what, that makes sense. You know, what do you think we should do? And then we go back and forth and we have a dialogue and I say, okay, well, what if we did this? And, you know, yeah, that's a great idea. Let's do that. So that's the way it's supposed to work. Unfortunately, the way it works a lot of times is once a politician sees a poll where, you know, 60, 70, 80% of their constituents feel a certain way, they think they're therefore obligated in order to respond to that way or do whatever is being demanded of. And that's not really what representative government's about. Representative government is not me taking a poll before I ever make a decision. One of the terms that I hate that's used all the time is, are you going to do, you know, what your constituents want you to do? And I always respond with, I'm going to do what I told my constituents I would do, right? Because a representative, the whole point of electing someone to represent you is you are delegating the political authority that you have as an individual to a representative to go and make decisions on your behalf. Well, implicit in that is the idea that I'm going to be sitting down, I'm going to be going to subcommittee hearings, full committee hearings, I'm going to be researching bills, I'm going to be reading through them, I'm going to be talking to various people that have different perspectives on this in order to come to a conclusion about what the best course of action is. The vast majority of our constituents are not doing those things because they've delegated that authority to us. They're living their lives. They're running their businesses. They're doing all the other things that they're supposed to do and that they need to do. And it doesn't mean that they're complete. It doesn't mean that citizens can be completely disengaged from policy or politics, but it does mean that I have a special responsibility to really dig into these issues. And my job when I'm running for office is to say, here's what I believe. This is my process. This is my worldview. This is how I go about thinking about issues. This is how I go about researching them in order to come to appropriate conclusions. And then you get to decide whether or not I'm representative of you. You get to decide on whether or not I'm the sort of person you want making those decisions when there is a time of crisis, when there is a lot of polling going on and media shaping things one way or another. But that's one thing I always emphasize is, you know, if you get your identity through politics, and this is, I think this is, goes to the heart of your question, Michael. If you really get your identity through politics, and getting elected is the most important thing to you, and I've seen good people come back where I'm like, why did you vote that way? Oh, well, you know, that's what my constituents want. I'm like, yeah, but it's not right. You know, it's not good policy. Well, yeah, but that's what they want, and you know, every once in a while you got it. I'm like, well, no, that's an abdication of responsibility. If you don't think it's good policy, your job is to then go back and explain why it's not good policy. And if that costs you an election, so be it. At least you maintained your integrity, right? But some people, they buy into the idea that, well, I've got to do some things I don't agree with in order to stay in office so I can do all these good things that I do agree with. Well, if you do that, you're going to find yourself more and more, you know, compromising to where at some point you really got to question, are you doing more good or more bad by putting your name onto something that you know is not right and then pushing it down the road. You know, I know what it's like to be the only no vote in the General Assembly. 99 yes, one no. And it was on controversial issues and people asked me why. I'm like, I just don't think this is the role of government. But it provided me an opportunity to actually explain and logically explain why it was that the course of action we took I thought was inappropriate. And some people will accept that and some people won't. And that's why we have elections. But ultimately, I have a responsibility to be true and be faithful to the commitments I made to my constituents with respect to my principles and the way I go about doing it. So the thing I would tell you is, for some politicians, it's just about doing the easiest thing to get reelected. For others, look, critical thinking is a dying skill set. You know, it is amazing to me the number of people that if you were in politics who have to constantly weigh these issues, which are going to carry with them the force and power of government, where we're going to send law enforcement to your home to potentially deprive you of property or liberty if you don't do what the law says. And they don't follow any sort of real critical thinking process that goes beyond, is this good for my reelection bid? So just understand, politicians operate off of incentives just like everybody else. The job of the electorate is to make sure that you do have elected officials that are effectively representing you and doing so in such a way that does make use of logic, reason, critical thinking, scientific analysis in order to come to effective conclusions. You know, again, so... But I think specifically on criminal justice reform, why is it so difficult for the left and right to work together on this? Again, I think that you have some people on the right that are sometimes worried about appearing like they're not for law and order. You have some people on the left that are worried about appearing that they're too pro-police. And I've always thought that this is one situation where we should be able to find some really good policies that make sense, right? That are not, you can be pro-criminal justice reform without being anti-law enforcement. In fact, I think true criminal justice reform is actually pro-law enforcement. But you need to have people willing to make the argument, which means you need to have people that are willing to risk not getting reelected to make those arguments. I don't mind doing that because ultimately I don't get my identity from politics. I get my identity from my faith. I get my identity from being a husband and a father, from being a a veteran. I recognize politics as a tremendous honor and responsibility, but it's not my identity. It's not my career. It's none of those things. It's a term of service. So thank you again for the question, Michael. I hope that answered it. So one of the videos we did a breakdown on was the whole idea of privilege. And I think a lot of us have gotten really, really frustrated by this conversation because a lot of times when you see the argument coming from the left, it's almost as if anything that you've done in your life can somehow be chalked up to privilege, and therefore you can't take any credit for it, you can't be proud of it, and in fact, you should probably be ashamed, and we should probably find ways to steal whatever it was that you know, quote-unquote, earned or took through privilege in order to redistribute it to the people the left wants to redistribute to. And that's infuriating, and quite frankly, it's insulting. Now, some of the counter responses I think go too far. Does privilege exist? Yeah. But the point is that all of us are privileged in some way, shape, or form, right? And just because you grew up with more money, well, that may be one aspect of the privilege, but if you grew up in a totally dysfunctional house that had more money, that might not have conveyed more privilege than someone that grew up in a poorer household that did have a strong family network. So it's important that, you know, one person over here that grew up that has just a natural inclination for learning foreign languages, is that privilege? Yeah, sure. You know, but they still have to develop that capability in order to turn it into something valuable and worthwhile. You know, the person that was growing up that is just a natural born athlete, is that privilege? Yeah, but they're probably not going to play for the NFL one day unless they actually develop it and work really hard to develop those natural talents and abilities. So the whole argument that I was making within that thing is, each one of us has some sort of privilege. Some of us have more privileges than others, but largely the reason why someone might be starting off with more advantages is because their parents made good decisions on their behalf. And I don't think we should be demonizing the practice of parents making good decisions, right? That's something we should encourage, not try to diminish or make people feel guilty about. By the same token, if you have had some advantages and you see someone else that's struggling that maybe hasn't, yeah, we should definitely have a feeling to want to help that person out. I think one of the fascinating things about America is that we love underdogs, right? We love the story of somebody that rose above their circumstances and just really, you know, accomplished something. It's one of the cornerstones of the American experiment. The idea that regardless of where you start off in life, in America, you can go as far as talent and hard work will take you because the government and society is not going to come in and try to stomp you down like it did in most countries in the world, whether through an aristocracy or some sort of royal, you know, class system or whatever it is. That's not who we are as Americans. But we broke down this video and we talked about some of the flawed logic that was being used. And I was trying to be careful because I do think that the people that created this video had good intentions. I just think that some of the logic that they used was bad. And Deborah Evans asked, do you think the kids used in the privilege illustration were feeling set up and exploited? I don't know. I don't know. I think that they probably felt a little bit awkward. They probably felt a little bit uneasy. They probably felt a little bit guilty. And I think that was one of the things that bothered me about it is, you know, for those of you that haven't seen the podcast episode, I encourage you to take a look at it. And if you can, watch it on YouTube because you'll actually see, I'm describing the video if you're on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. But if you can go to our YouTube channel, you can actually see the video and what's going on. That was kind of one of my main problems with the way it was set up. Is, you know, the guy gets everybody out in a line and he says, we're going to have a race for a $100 bill. And then he says, you know, if you answer yes to any of these questions, then take two steps forward. And it was all questions like, you know, if your parents are still married, take two steps forward. If you, you know, had a tutor, take two steps forward. If you're, you know, if you never had to worry about where your next meal was coming from, take two steps forward. And then he did ones where it was kind of selective. You kind of knew the fix was in when he said things like, if you know you don't have to worry about paying for college for something other than your athletic ability, take two steps forward. Okay, well, why is athletic ability any less a privilege if you were born with certain talents that you developed, right? So that was some of the problems I had with it. But the biggest problem I had with it was this. He was making life out to be a race where all of us are competing against one another in order to, and one person wins. That's not what life is at all. Right? And if you view life that way and you're viewing everyone else as your competition instead of your fellow travelers, you're going to have a pretty depressing existence. What I have found is that life more often than not is not me competing with my fellow human beings, it's cooperating with them. We all have goals and some of those goals are similar and some of those goals are completely different. So we're not all running to the same place. We all have different objectives. And it's beautiful when we can all work together in order to help each other achieve those objectives. And yes, some of it's going to be competitive. But even in the competition, it makes both sides better usually through the process. And what a envious and greedy existence to go through your entire life trying to find the privileges that somebody else has, to complain about it or to envy them or to suggest that, you know, they owe you something because their parents, you know, read to them at night. I mean, how absurd. Instead of focusing on the advantages other people have, why don't you focus on the advantages that you have? Because that's what a market economy and cooperation is all about. You know, I had the same opportunity to compete in the NBA that Michael Jordan did. What I lacked was any sort of natural ability, right? But that wasn't a bad thing. My life isn't worse because Michael Jordan was a wonderful basketball player. My life was better. I enjoyed watching him play. I would hate the idea that anyone would try to come in and shackle somebody or prevent them from doing their best because they might be better at something than I am. No, I want to find the thing I'm best at. So instead of this like obsession with, oh, well, that person has that advantage or that person has that privilege, why don't we just let everybody be the best they can be? And one of the things that I find so amazing, one of the experiences that I've had from my life, is this idea that if you grow up with wealth and privilege, then that automatically means that you've got all these advantages. You know, some of the loneliest people I've ever met and some of the most dysfunctional people I've ever met grow up in wealthy households. Some of the most successful people I've met had to build everything from the ground up. And a lot of it was about their perspective. I saw people that had the advantages of maybe wealth that flaunted it or didn't actually take advantage of it because they just thought it was owed to them. I've seen other people that had all kinds of challenges in life and they looked at it as an opportunity to rise above. So look, privilege, talent, that only gets you so far, right? Your ability, how you look at a situation and how you choose to engage with challenges, that's what really determines success more often than not from what I've found. And so I don't know if the kids in that illustration felt a little bit set up or exploited, but I do think on some level, whether it was intended or not, they were made to feel guilty about good decisions their parents made. And I think that's ridiculous. In fact, if you wanted to make that more effective, here's what you should have done. Line up all the parents and say, okay, how many of you have made good decisions based off of X, Y, or Z? All right, understand something. The more good decisions you make, the more of a stable environment you provide for your children, the more opportunities that you're providing them in life. That would have been a much better perspective on the whole concept of, you know, privilege or advantage. Is what can we do to make sure that we are providing these advantages to our kids? Because I'm sick of people saying that, well, whenever there's a disparity, there's an automatic cause for the government to come in and try to fix it. And a lot of the problems that we see ourselves in right now are a direct result of the government trying to fix a problem that they had no capacity, no real insight, and no real place to fix in the first place. You know, the government's job is to, again, protect your liberty, provide equality of justice before the law, but nobody can provide equality of outcomes. Can you imagine the amount of oppression and violence that would be necessary to achieve equality of outcomes? So, I think that's what we need to do. Is just focus more on the opportunities that you have, the challenges that you're facing, and how you're gonna address them. And that was one of my biggest problems is the seed that was being planted in those kids' minds, I don't think was simply, hey, help somebody out that might not have the same advantages, because I think that's a good message. And I think that was probably what was intended. But there was a lot of other things that were put in there that could lead kids to some really, really bad conclusions, especially bad political conclusions about what society's role versus the individual's role is with respect to helping other people. Okay, we have another question here. We're going to mix it up a little bit. Like I said, every 8 p.m. on Tuesday nights, I do a Facebook Live town hall, and we answer a lot of questions about policy issues and things like that. And Phil Summer said, from an economic standpoint, keeping the economy strong, et cetera, Please explain your stance on free markets. So here's what the free market is, and we've done this a little bit. We've talked about socialism versus capitalism. We've talked about cronyism versus capitalism. And we're going to have some more podcasts coming up in the future when we actually talk about fascism versus capitalism, because there's a lot of talk now about fascism and Antifa and things like that. And people on the right are always accused of being fascist. But when you look at the actual economic policies of fascist governments, whether it was Germany, Spain, Italy, what you find is they bear far more resemblance to more leftist-oriented political philosophy and economic policy than they do the conservative. But here's what free markets are. And it's interesting. I'll give you an illustration. I had somebody say once, well, Nick, you're pro-business. And I said, well, I'm pro-free market. And like, what do you mean by that? I said, well, I believe that being pro-free market is pro-business. I said, but my problem is I hear some Republicans say they're pro-business, and what they mean is they're pro-cronyist. They're pro using the government to pick winners and losers in the economy. That's not what I believe. The free market, capitalism, could be explained this way. It's the private ownership of the means of production and distribution through a system of voluntary exchange. And the key feature of that, a lot of people, when they think capitalism, they think the key feature is competition. It's actually not true. Competition is an important component of capitalism, but actually the most important, the fundamental component of capitalism is cooperation, right? Because the only way you can produce anything requires some degree of cooperation. Almost everything you buy, none of it was made entirely in-house by one factory or one worker or whatever it was, right? The rocking chair you had, there had to be a lumberjack in order to cut down the lumber. There had to be somebody working a plant to design the chainsaw. There had to be somebody working to manufacture the truck. There had to be a truck driver. There had to be somebody out there paving the roads, right? There's all of these different things that come into play no matter what we're talking about. In fact, there was a great article written by, I think it was Leonard Reed, called iPencil, and he does a great job of explaining how complex the means of production are to create a pencil and everything that goes into making it and the thousands of people all over the world working together in voluntary cooperation to bring you a pencil at a very, very affordable price. So that's what free markets are. It's about voluntary cooperation in the exchange of goods and services to mutual benefit. You know, that's the other reason why I think that there's too much emphasis among Republicans on competition, because competition implies that there's a winner and a loser. And what's amazing about 99.999% of transactions is that they're both winners at the end of them, right? When I give you the $5 in exchange for the coffee, I wanted the coffee more than I wanted the $5. You wanted the $5 more than you wanted the coffee. And so now both of us are better off as a result of the transaction. So we should want as many of those sort of positive voluntary transactions as we can possibly get, because that's what keeps the economy going. So I think that one of the reasons why free markets sometimes get a bad rap is because free markets are sometimes blamed for things that are inherent in human nature. So humans are fallible. We make mistakes. Sometimes we have, you know, bad end states, right? That doesn't stop with the economic system you choose. The real question with the economic system is what sort of incentive structures are being created as a result of it. So in a socialist system, you don't have an incentive to work hard because you're not really rewarded for extra hard work. You have an incentive to try to get out of work because you're kind of paid the same as a result. You're not really incentivized to seek to engage in entrepreneurial endeavors, which actually lead to greater innovation and efficiency and effectiveness, because again, you're not rewarded for any of that. In a socialist system, you're just kind of rewarded for doing what the government tells you to do. And since their emphasis is on, you know, their version of equity as opposed to each person being able to, work or produce whatever they can to be more effective and efficient, you don't have an emphasis to produce. And that's what you see it was amazing. I was talking to somebody I served in the military with who lived in communist Russia, and he was talking about how there was a big market for getting for basically paying off your doctor to get a sick notice. Because again, you were going to get compensated regardless of how hard you worked. Now, the way that the Soviet government cracked down on that was if you got caught doing that, there was very, very draconian punishments for it. So it was, socialism, communism, fascism, these are all very, very authoritarian systems when it comes to micromanaging the economy. Obviously, we don't have a purely free market economy. Probably the freest economy in the world used to be Hong Kong before the Chinese communists started really cracking down. Singapore is another great example. The United States is usually within the top 10 to top 12. And the way that we look at a free economy is things like, you know, do you have property rights? Is it easy to start a business? Are tax burdens low? Are regulatory burdens low? Is the monetary policy of the country sound? So again, I think the more freedom that we can put into the economy, the better results we're going to get. And again, that doesn't mean you're going to get perfect results, because it's still human beings. It's fallible human beings making these decisions. But the question that you have to ask yourself when you are trying to determine who should be making the economic decision, do you want someone making the economic decision that pays a real price or realizes a real benefit from getting the decision correct, right? Or do you want some politician making the decision based off of their desire to get reelected? Because for a politician, and I can't remember who made the statement, but he said, democracy has to be more than two wolves and one sheep taking a vote on what to have for dinner, right? And when a politician figures out that if they steal from 49% of the population and give it to 51% of the population, they'll constantly get reelected, that is a recipe for disaster in society. Because what you've essentially taught people is your ability to succeed in the economy is not based off of how well you serve your fellow citizens in the marketplace by providing products and services, but rather your key to economic success is how cozy you are to a politician. And that's really the breakdown here. I'm not just a capitalist or a proponent of free markets because it produces better economic results. I'm a fan of it because I believe it is vastly morally superior to every other economic system out there that tries to put decisions in the hands of politicians as opposed to in the hands of producers, the people that are consuming the products, et cetera, et cetera. So I hope that answers your question with respect to my stance on the free market. So these are all the questions that we've received today. I want to encourage you to ask more. This was a lot of fun for me. I love going through and answering questions because it does two things. One, it tells me what's really on your mind. It also tells me whether or not the point I was trying to get across in the podcast really hit, or if there's ways that I need to refine my messaging to make sure that I'm coming across, you know, clear, concise. But again, this was a lot of fun for me. So I highly encourage you, send us some questions. One of the best ways to do it is to go onto our YouTube channel. You can also go through our website, nick4va.com. Also, consider leaving us a rating. Give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or I don't think Spotify has them, Apple Podcasts. Give us a thumbs up on YouTube. Share it with your friends. The more feedback we get, the better content we can deliver. So once again, I want to thank you too, real quick here. Deborah, Michael, Joe, Chip, Phil, and Janice for your questions. We look forward to more here in the future. Every once in a while, we'll do one of these podcasts where we just go through and we answer audience questions. But thank you very much for joining us again here on Making the Argument with Nick Freitas, and we'll see you next time.
Once again, thank you very much for listening. If you want to support the show, again, one of the best ways you can do it is by heading over to goodranchers.com with promo code Nick. You're going to get $15 off. You sign up for one of those subscriptions and you're going to get up to $480 of free meat with that subscription. You get to pick top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, bacon. It is all up to you. Plus, if you're looking for gifts to get for the people that are impossible to shop for, goodranchers.com also has gift boxes. You need to act quick. This is part of their overall Black Friday special. So head on over to goodranchers.com, use promo code Nick, and once again, thank you for listening.